Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers, Crumbs on the Sheets, where we take a broader look at the education, learning and teaching industry community, and we go a little bit more in depth into topics that are on our minds and have been suggested by you, our viewers. But first, introductions. I'm Neil of Team Teacher.
Hello everybody, it's Professor Leach.
What tasty morsels do we have on the sheets today?
Well, first of all, I guess, I wanted to speak a bit about my kind of recent transition into a slightly different area of teaching, which is that, after 15 years of primarily TEFL teaching with a little bit of academic purposes stuff in there, a little bit of summer school work in there as well. I've now moved over to be primarily what they call an ESOL teacher. It took me a little bit of a while to kind of realize what that means. And obviously in different contexts, it does mean different things. I remember a couple of years ago, someone told me that ESL was just the term that they use in the United States, whereas they use EFL or ELT in the UK. But actually, that's certainly not the difference in the UK. There is a difference. So when they say ESOL in the UK, they're referring specifically to people who are living in the country and studying the language at the same time. And there's quite a few. It also tends to be linked to government qualifications. And that is what I'm doing at the moment. I'm teaching government qualifications. Interestingly enough, not internationally recognized, and apparently that's deliberate. The government, actually, the people who are doing these qualifications, the government want them to be kind of committed to the UK. So they deliberately want the qualifications to be sort of UK only.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what do these qualifications, are they allowed on UK immigration official documents and stuff like that? So along with like IELTS and the Cambridge, I think, is also something
that's right
that tends to be
accepted. Yeah, they're on immigration documents. They'll be accepted certainly in terms of college courses. They'll be accepted as proof of your language level if you were to go on and study a vocational college course. I'm not quite sure about universities, but I would imagine that's something I need to look into, actually. I would imagine that the government would compel the universities to accept these qualifications, actually. I would certainly imagine so. And I'm pretty certain that they have to accept them for work as well. So if you're going for a job and they say, oh, we want you to provide us with, an IELTS score or something, pretty sure that you can use this qualification. I'm gonna have to check this. I'm not sounding very good, am I? Saying I'm pretty sure, you can use this qualification to prove your English level, and the levels are entry 1, 2, 3, and then level 1, level 2, and level 2 roughly corresponds to advanced, kind of emerging advanced. So level 2 is really that's the level. That's the level they need to get to do anything, really.
My question would be, is all of these have different levels or bands or whatever they refer to. But for me, mostly it's about assessment. So for my experience, you've got, when I've taught IELTS and when I've taught at private institutions, they make up these levels, and they are generally based on like the frameworks, like the A1, A2, B, C, whatever. But often, you'll find that private institutions, there's an incentive, so they'll game it. They'll be like, they've been in the B1 class for a while, so we'll bump them. They've got a bit of experience or whatever, so it can be gamed, I find. Whereas with the IELTS one, it's externally assessed, so I teach it, but obviously they have IELTS examiners, so it's nothing to do with me when it's assessed. They get the grade, and it's it's all on them. Well, how is it with, you know, the institution you work with?
Well, like I say, it's not just the institution I work with, but it's pretty much everyone, all of the colleges following this program, which I think is all of the, or the majority of the ESOL colleges in the UK. Mm-hmm. The curriculum itself is called, or the course, I suppose, is called Skills for Life. So it's English Skills for Life, mm-hmm. Which should indicate to you that it's not quite as academic as, for example, IELTS. IELTS is tends to be the academic program that people follow, mm-hmm. which involves, you know, an essay writing in the writing, for example. Whereas this Skills for Life, you know, it's, well, Skills for Life. It's what English do you need to kind of operate day to day in England, to get a job, to fill out application forms, to, I don't know, complain about a meal at a restaurant or whatever. So that kind of stuff, it's kind of living in the country, and mm-hmm. it's aimed at that. Now, the assessment is something that I have a big problem with, as you might imagine. I mean, I'm not, I could criticize Cambridge English assessments all day. I could criticize IELTS assessments. There's loads of problems with them, but they are streets ahead of what they're doing in this Skills for Life stuff, honestly. So I can only really speak a great deal about the writing assessment, because the way that it's split up at my college, where I teach, is that we teach a semester aimed at writing, semester aimed at listening and speaking, and then one aimed at reading. And I've only been here so far for the writing one. Also, by the way, that kind of distribution is something that I completely disagree with. I don't know why you would separate the skills in that way. It's not something that I've kind of pushed back on at the institution just yet, because I haven't been there long enough to start rocking the boat too much. But it is something that I will bring up, because I don't think, well, I mean, it should be, I think it's obvious that that's not a great way. I mean, you want to spend 3 months teaching writing, do you?
It sounds, you know, like that was decided by someone that was not, that didn't have a background with English teaching.
It's
something that the government would decide, just be like,
it's very possible. Well, funnily enough, I don't think the government actually do prescribe that. So I'm not sure about that. I'm going to have to look into it. But yeah, it's something that I don't think makes a great deal of sense. Mm-hmm. And if you think that the intensive course, which is what the vast majority of my students do, is it's 12 hours a week, mm-hmm. for 11 weeks. Can you imagine that? 12 hours a week, 11 weeks writing. It's madness, really, when you think about it. It's totally, anyone can see that that's madness. But anyway, yeah. That's what you're supposed to do. Obviously, I don't do that. I do 4 skills every class, you know, primarily speaking and productive things, and a bit of writing in class, but also writing tends to be for homework, with a bit of autonomous correction and peer correction and other stuff to work on in class. Anyway, going back to the assessment. So let's talk about level 2, right? Because I said the ultimate aim is to get to this level 2, which is C1, basically.
Level 2. Oh, great.
It's what you need to do anything. If one of my students wants to study a carpentry course at the college, mm-hmm. then first they need level 2 English, mm-hmm. and then they can go and do that course, that HND or
MVQ,
AD level, or whatever the hell they call it. I don't know. They've all got weird new names for these things now. Mm-hmm. But whatever, vocational course, they need the level 2. So they have to get there. So the level 2 is the top one. So let's talk about the writing for the level 2. What do you have to do? There's 2 tasks. 50 minutes. Sorry, there's 3 tasks. But we split them. We do task 1 on its own, and then we do task 2 and 3 as a separate exam. I don't know why. That's just what they do. Task 1 is just filling out a form. It's quite a complex form. I don't particularly have a problem with that, because I do understand that, especially foreigners in a country, you have to fill out a lot of forms. You remember when we were living in Spain? You know, you have to go through some bureaucratic stuff, and it's a bit difficult, you know. Mm-hmm. It's something that it is worth knowing how to do, and how to do well, and doing it well. So I don't have a problem with the form one too much. Mm-hmm. There's things you could say about it, but anyway, it doesn't matter. The big problem I have is with task 2 and 3, which is the main tasks. They're 50 minutes each. So task 2 is a letter, mm-hmm. right? A written letter with a letterhead and all that. Mm-hmm. You have to write your address and their address at the top, you know, like writing a letter. Have you ever done that in your life?
Well, yeah, I'm old.
I mean,
so,
actually,
yeah,
handwritten it. And
yeah, no.
Handwritten it.
Oh, handwritten, no, but I've typed it out, yeah.
You mean you've opened up Microsoft Word, opened up a template of a letter, mm-hmm. and then filled in the details, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's slightly different. But anyway, yeah, they have to do it. They have to handwrite it. And the letters are things like writing to your newspaper to complain about the closure of the local A&E.
Okay.
Or writing to the council to protest the McDonald's being built over your local park.
Okay. Well, it's to be honest, it doesn't sound that bad in comparison to the IELTS, the general IELTS, where it's like, write a letter to your friend after you come back off holiday or whatever. Okay. You know, I feel like that's a little bit more applicable to a citizen.
Yeah.
Good citizenship. You know,
that's true. Do they still do that though? Haven't they changed that
for IELTS, the general one?
Yeah. I don't know if they still do those kind of like casual emails to friends. I'm pretty sure within the last 10 years, I'm not sure they were emails.
I think they were letters. Yeah, write a letter to your pen pal.
Obviously that's that's insane. That's just totally insane. Nobody does that. One person in like a million probably writes letters to friends. Yeah. But anyway, I don't like it. It is a good display of English, I suppose, but it's synthetic. It's not only have I never written a letter like that, especially written. I mean, I've sent emails maybe, but I've written a letter like that. I don't think I know anyone who's written a letter like that. I'd have to speak to Danny, but I don't think I know anyone who's written a letter to their council protesting something, actually written one. Because you can go on the council's website and a form will come up where you can send messages to, you know, the local planning committee or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So I have a big problem with that. And then task three, write an article, because of course it is, because of course all of these people are going to go on and become article journalists, apparently. So yeah, you have to write an article, and that's on just wild out there topics, you know. It's article stuff like write an article about your five top tips for getting to know new people or something like that.
Okay.
Don't
that
like
seems
it
a bit like busy work.
It's yeah, I'm not keen on it at all. And on top of that, I mean, task aside, because that's me whinging about the tasks, that's not my biggest issue with it, actually. My biggest issue with it is how it's assessed. And it's assessed very much. First of all, they use positive marking. Do you know what that is?
Explain it for our viewers, please.
Of course. I'll take that as a no. So positive marking is basically if you get it, it's like, can they do this? Have they done this? Yes. And then it doesn't matter if 200 times they do it wrong. If they've done it right once, they get the tick, right? That's how positive marking works. So it's not like, it doesn't matter technically how many bad things you can find, as long as you can find the good thing that meets the criteria. Okay, that's the idea of positive marking. So let's say one of the marking criteria on one of the earlier exams, it might say something like, you must have two sentences with correct word order and correct word form, right? Mm-hmm. And you find the first sentence, you know, I like cheese, tick. I buy cheese at the supermarket, tick. Mm-hmm. And then every other sentence in their writing is just absolute gobbledygook with spelling all over the place and it just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. They've got that marking criteria. So that's the point. That's positive marking, right? It's like you're not punishing someone once they've shown they can achieve what you're asking for. So I agree with that. I like positive marking. I agree with it. Mm-hmm. But then the problem is the marking criteria is focused, insanely focused on accuracy and form. So it's all about accuracy and form. They're mad about it. They want you to have, like the one I just said there, with perfect word order, perfect word form. So that means that you could have a student who writes 15 sentences at a basic level that are great and communicate a message. But let's say that they, in each of those sentences, they either miss out a word, like a preposition, mm-hmm. or they miss the S on the third person form, or they write an extra word, or just something silly. They miss the article, something like that, right? And they fail because they didn't have one single sentence that's absolutely perfect, even though they've written some really interesting sentences. And perhaps the reason why they didn't have one that's perfect is that their language is actually better than that. And instead of just writing, "I like cheese," they wrote like, "I particularly think cheese is quite nice because it helps my healthy."
Yeah.
Well, they don't get a mark for that, even though that's a pretty interesting sentence.
Yeah.
Right? Because the marking criteria is so focused on accuracy and form.
So that's it's kind of like a problems with that would be that it tries to put people into that box of this is the correct way to speak English or any given language.
Totally.
And that, you know, languages don't work that way. I understand it. Yeah.
That's 100% what it is. So it's
which will reinforce with students like, I don't speak English well because I don't speak it in this way, and you know, you're constantly trying to go, no, you actually speak better. It's just you don't, you know, speak with a plum up your mum. But
there is a huge juxtaposition between how I teach and then what I'm telling them about the exam. And that makes it very grating for the students because, you know, I'm very much about communicative achievement, not punishing errors, you know, a bit of error correction, but it's not a slap on the wrist. It's sort of a, well done, here's how you can do it better. You know, that is how I teach. And, you know, I'm just totally convinced that that's how you teach languages from all my experience, everything I've read, everything I know about it. You know, I'm just totally convinced that's how you produce someone who one day is going to be a fluent language user and a confident one, and someone who can kind of autonomously teach themselves as well because they're confident in their own ability. But then I have to, when I'm teaching them about the exam, I have to suddenly use this horrible strict criteria and start saying to them, oh, you need a perfect sentence, you need a perfect word order, that's what it says, correct word form order, correct word form in the sentence. So if there's one thing out, that sentence doesn't count. So suddenly you have this huge structured, like, rigid thing that you have to teach them, and it is jarring. And I'll tell you, last week one of my students, right, because I love doing you know, communicative stuff, obviously it's all communicative stuff, and we were doing some group work and they were talking together about different festivals in the UK. like, I'd showed them a video of like the cheese rolling festival and St. George's Day and Jack in the Green and some different festivals about the UK. And they were having a nice chat about, and then suddenly I come in to kind of join in and listen to them. One of the students just piped up, looked at me, completely changed the topic. And he said, "Rich, do you think it's useful for us to talk like this?" And I was shocked to get the question, because you never get students really saying something like that. And this, by the way, this is a beginner class. This is entry one. So this will be like A1/A2. But they tend to have quite good speaking because they live in the country.
Yeah. Right?
So at least they can communicate. And he said, "Don't you think that we'll pick up errors from each other?" You know, he was really worried about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I could see that he was kind of a bit stressed about it. It's kind of like he felt like, oh, am I getting dirty here speaking to the non-natives and picking up errors, and my English isn't going to be good and people won't understand me. You know, he had all those concerns. And I had to kind of go on this massive tangent. It took a long time because obviously at their level, I can't just explain to them, well, communicative language teaching, rationale, 15 years, blah, 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 blah. Right? They won't understand anything. So I had to like really carefully and slowly explain, like, you know, the benefits and how, you know, error transfer is minimal. Even when it happens, they weed themselves out through communicative achievement. Communication is the best way of learning. And if you learn based on accuracy, then it won't stick. You know, it's just like, you're just like studying to pass an exam and you'll forget it all afterwards and blah, 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 blah. You know, you have to go through the whole damn thing. And I can't say for sure why that student asked that question. It could be anything, but it certainly doesn't help that I'm having to give them mixed messages. You know, I'm having to, on the one hand, teach them, this is how you learn a language, and then on the other hand, say, but in the exam, do this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because it's one of the reasons that we started this channel, isn't it? That we are pushing back on the idea of this teaching like a not a standard per se, but teaching has to be done in a certain way, and that certain way is to achieve a pass an exam to gain a credential, when often, you know, teaching comes in many forms, and it's, you can't just apply a arbitrary criteria to it. It has to be broader and a little bit more adaptive, but it's always, it seems it's always a balance between being freer and going, yeah, look, they got their message across, but I'm like, Rich, it was interpretive dance, this is an English class, you know, we've got to have some standards, you know, they're all gesticulating, they got the message, but still, you know, we have to have, because, you know, where do you draw the line, right? Yeah. You know, like, what they said is not the correct sentence structure, but was the other sentence structure that they used, was that correct? So that it's kind of like a decision tree, but a language tree. And I don't think a lot of credentials have really wrapped their head around that, you know? You ask a prompt, and then when they look at the answer sheet, there's only one form to answer, or maybe a variable or two or three, when it really, it should be the whole spectrum of English. And how do you do that? Well, I think we're going to be getting into ways to do that, and we can touch on that later, but I think you want to carry on with this.
Well, I just wanted to respond to something you just said there. Sure. It rubs off on the students in that way that I was speaking about, you know, there's kind of a juxtaposition between how I want to teach and the exams. Mm-hmm. But also it rubs off on the teachers, and you can tell that, especially the teachers who've been there quite a long time. Not all of them, but certainly some of them, you know, are kind of standing on the more sort of prescriptive side of the way of doing things. And I do think that teachers in institutions kind of naturally gravitate towards that anyway. I mean, I saw it when I was teaching at the university in Valencia, especially the non-native teachers who hadn't done a CELTA, they'd kind of gone the sort of philology route or whatever, you know, linguistic expert route. And they were very sort of prescriptive about the way they taught, you know, and they were teaching kind of spending a lot of time teaching form and teaching the correct order of adjectives before a noun and all that kind of stuff, which I just think is a total waste of time. It's worth looking at it a little bit, but the fact that you're actually going to teach someone, right, so before the noun, it's, you know, size, color, opinion, blah, or whatever. I didn't even know what it is. But I just think that's totally the wrong way of. I think the way of learning that is to learn collocations, phrases, complex noun phrases that naturally have that. Oh, this is my big red ball or whatever, and there's your star, right? So you know that size becomes before color because
English is an academic subject rather than a communicative language.
That's it. Yeah. I'd mentioned with this entry one class, this kind of beginner class. You know, we did the pass the other day, pass simple, right? We did a bit of pass simple, you know, and suddenly one of the teachers looks at me and she's like, oh, why did you do that? And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, oh, well, pass simple's not on the exam. It's just present simple, present continuous on the exam. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I did it because I wanted to talk to them about their weekends.
Yeah.
I want to know what they did last weekend, you know, and stuff. It's a communicative language class, you know. I wanted to speak to them about the weekend. It's the past bloody simple. They need it. So, I thought that just the reaction was almost like a slap on the wrist for me.
Yeah.
You know, oh, how dare you teach them the past simple when it's not on the exam? I mean, it wasn't like that. She's a very nice lady, actually. She didn't quite, but I could see that she was kind of a bit like, well, don't know if that was a good use of time. But
from her perspective, it's like you're making more work for yourself and possibly them, because it's not useful for them at that moment in regards to the exam, not just in a broader communicative language use learn.
I think it's misunderstanding as well, like how people learn. It's kind of seeing people as, oh, we have 12 hours a week, and let's say the students have some sort of, they're like a battery, and you just hammer them with stuff and that battery goes down. And it's kind of like, if you waste some of that time on something else, then you're wasting that battery that should be used on the stuff that's on the exam. It's seeing it like that, rather than seeing it as more, are the students engaged? Are they interested? Are they having fun? Are they communicating? Because if they're doing any or all of those things, then they'll learn effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to, are they bored? Are they doing the same thing again and again? Are they sitting there writing in silence? You know, all of these things are not
conducive. The communicative way will actually increase their battery capacity, because, you know, they'll have that intrinsic feeling of progress, of that they are never actually acquiring a skill, which you know, is very motivational.
That's it. Yeah, 100%. And it's one of the things that we, on all of our guests that we've had on the show, it's one of the things that we cover again and again, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, I think Patrick Jackson set the tone. You know, when I think my first question for him was, you know, Patrick, what about engagement? What do you think? How important is that? And his answer was, well, it's everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think, it is, actually. I agree with him.
Yeah. And going a bit deeper, making it what's being taught and what's being learned relatable and applicable in their day-to-day lives. So I am glad that at least, you know, listening to what you're saying about the assessment with the writing, that it's taking that into account, that these people, these learners, scholars, as I've heard some teachers refer to them as, are learning stuff that they will use in their life. You know, I mean, maybe not all of them would write a letter to the council, but, you know, the majority will fill out a form rather than just, you know, write some academic essay or something like that, where or just some random stuff, I guess, like the articles where you're like, how does this do it? Maybe they should be writing like Facebook posts or a tweet on Twitter to their local restaurant saying that, you know, they had a nice meal or something like that. I don't know, what would you put there instead?
Well, I think
something.
I think there's definitely an argument to have like written, really it should be done on your phone, but certainly like a message conversation. And I think you could do it like, you basically have like a snippet of a conversation.
Oh, like booking a hairdresser appointment on an app or something like that.
I mean, that's a good idea. I was thinking more about chatting with friends. So like, you've got like a WhatsApp group with your people who you play tennis with or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And there's a little thread about something. And then it's like, it gets to the point where, you know, because occasionally in these things you have to type a long message, and that's where they're going to struggle, obviously. So there's a bit of a thread, right? And you see that on the exam, and then you have to write like 50 words explaining something that you want to say to the group. Like, I don't know, it could just be something, it could, in the earliest levels, it could be something like, say that you can't attend this week because you've got a doctor's appointment, you want to attend next week, you know. And you just have like bullet points, and the students would then have to put that into language, right? So something like that would be quite useful for them, because, you know, they are going to be doing that. They're going to be in WhatsApp groups with people who don't speak their native language. They have to speak English to them, and they have to explain kind of complex things that they've never explained before. Mm-hmm. So that would be useful. And at higher levels, you know, it'd have to be some sort of discussion or something like that. You've also got comments on pages, like you were saying, a Facebook style thing. Obviously, you wouldn't want to include the branding, but you could just say, you're going on social media and you want to post something, you know. I think that actually would be a good idea.
You want to write some gushing remarks to try to get a date with that girl on OnlyFans. on her landing page or whatever.
I think we'd be treading on rather dangerous ground if we went there, but something like that.
Professor Rich in Shades of Grey.
Yeah, Professor Rich like transitions into dating coaching. Language learning and dating coach. No, I don't think so. So
love is a language that we all need to speak.
Okay. Anyway, so yeah, there's that. And then as for the right, because obviously you do need some sort of formal writing. I think academic assignments are kind of a good one. The whole essay thing. It is quite useful because anyone who's going to go and study something academic does need that. Then the other thing I would say is emails and probably something like not necessarily a job application, but like kind of a job inquiry. Because I don't know about you, but I've written quite a lot of those in my time.
Oh, maybe like a cover letter, yeah.
So yeah, it's like a cover letter. It's like a cover letter, but where there's not even really a job. And I'm just kind of sending a message to say like, hey, got any jobs, you know?
Oh yeah, I did a ton of those when I was applying for like media stuff way back in the day where I got no experience, and that those were the times that I was thinking of where I like actually did a letterhead and stuff like that. But right. You know, that was when I was like 16.
Okay, well I've done loads of them over the past sort of 10 years. Yeah. And you know, I've landed jobs from them. Oh, nice. You know, and you need to know how to write stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing would just be the other thing would probably be an in-company email. So this would be a bit more difficult because it's difficult to make it applicable to everyone. It becomes quite contextual. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if you work in a company, as you do and I do, you'll know email is quite a big part of it. Mm-hmm. It tends to be more reading emails than writing emails. But you know, when you do have to write an email, you have to. There is a convention for it. And you'd need to know how to do it. So if you're going to do writing, then that'd be the way of doing it. Of course, with tools like Grammarly and, you know, the advances in AI, which I think we're going to talk about some stage. If not today, then I'm sure we'll dive into it because it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, that technology is coming on so much now. I think we're almost getting at the point where I would start to argue that it's not necessary to teach writing. Highly controversial, especially in my area, because writing is the skill that our students struggle with most. So they're speaking, it's like the inverse of TEFL. Mm-hmm. ESOL students tend to have really good listening and speaking. Mm-hmm. But they have poor reading and writing, and some of them can't write in their own language, for example. Mm-hmm. So you see, it's a big difference than the kind of wealthy.
Why don't we wade into this a little bit with the writing? I think something like the chatbots, ChatGPT is the buzzword at the moment, can really do is help emulate that writing equivalent of speaking, because with the writing often as you talk about it's writing these long form emails or articles or cover letters or something like that, when a lot of writing actually is more message based. So
yeah,
I can definitely foresee with the advent of these chatbots that there be more ability for teachers and students to practice writing in a short form. And I'm not sure how that would be implemented at this stage. Yeah. But you know, students will, I'm 100% will be going onto ChatGPT Right now, these students are, you know, non-native English speakers, and they'll be, you know, talking to ChatGPT in English, and it will be responding back to them in English. Now, I'd love to see an interaction between an ESL, EFL, ESL, ESOL, whatever, and ChatGPT to see how ChatGPT, you know, negotiates and works with them. You know, what does it say? No, nah, don't understand what you mean, mate. Or what? Or does it? Because what I found is, you know, like, even if I'm not grammatically correct, even if I'm, I ask it, I start a question, be like, how do I do this? And then end with you know, like a full stop, a period at the end without a question mark. It will answer as if I've asked a question.
Yeah.
So
it's way better than that, Neil. How much time have you spent talking to him?
I use it as a tool. I don't talk to him because I have my own theories with it. But I don't chat.
Okay. So I actually don't like ChatGPT that much. I don't know if it's been kind of, because I know they've been hamstringing it. Because of some of the offensive things it said. And I don't know if that's affected it and made it a bit more robotic. But the one that I've been playing with a lot is called character.ai. And I'm absolutely fascinated by it. And it actually allows you to make a character. So you can kind of do your own chatbot with its own personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made me. Let me show you this. Can I share my screen? Are we capable of doing that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do that. Let me know if the resolution's a bit weird, because I can make it full screen. It might be better. But...
Okay. So what we have here is Professor Rich and Professor Rich.
That's right. So the this guy with the picture, mm-hmm. that's actually the bot. That's the bot, and he says, "I am Professor Rich."
Or
I'm a British,
is he a
English
bot?
Well, it might be both. Right, so I'm a British English teacher with 15 years experience. I prefer the lexical approach, blah, 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 blah. Right, so, and I've trained it quite a bit, and my students have been chatting with it. You can see it's had 506 chats, so people have been chatting with it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we say something to him, we say like, hey, Rich, what's something that I just said about the exams? So like...
exams need more stringent physical assessments.
Do you think that
I should teach cultural appropriate ways of writing, not just
let's try that. Do you think that writing exams are well designed? Let's see what he says. So we've just had that conversation. Okay?
Yeah. It's a bit vanilla, but yeah.
Yeah. Hey there, well, that's a great question. He's more friendly than I am. I would say that there's nothing wrong with the idea of an exam. After all, if a student doesn't have any ability to express themselves in writing or reading, then the results are bound to be questionable. However, the problem comes in the design of the exam itself. For example, most English writing exams I've seen often focus on formal academic English rather than creative, engaging, communicative, contemporary English that a language learner needs in everyday situations. That's pretty much what we just said.
Yeah, that's true.
Furthermore, that's true. They often focus on formal grammar rather than useful phrases.
So, how did you train this this thought?
So you can see at the bottom,
yeah.
You can give it a mark, right? You can say bad, terrible, good.
Okay.
And you can spin on as well and get it to regenerate. And the other thing you can do is, if we go into the settings,
mm-hmm.
is... I don't know if I've done it with this. Yes, I have. You can give him like one little conversation and prescribe the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one here that I give him a prescribed answer to, should I learn grammar? And the answer I prescribed was, that's a great question. I tend to take more of a functional approach to grammar. In other words, so I wrote that myself.
Yeah.
Right. And from that, and from what I've said here, that's where he gets his personality from, this little bot. And I think he does a pretty good job of mimicking me. Look, he's even said at the bottom, how's that useful? Like, I could even imagine, this is the kind of thing that I would say. Not maybe not quite in those words, but it's certainly got elements of my teaching personality.
So basically, this is trained as you as a teacher rather than you as, you know,
yeah,
the broader diamond faceted person right. that you are.
If we start asking him what his favorite video game is, I can't imagine what he would possibly say.
Can we ask him who his favorite teacher is?
Okay. I mean, this is likely to be way off. I'd be surprised.
It's going to be me. It's got to be me.
I don't have a favorite teacher. But I do have a favorite teaching methodology. That is the lexical approach, which focuses less on rules and more on useful phrases and flexible word chunks.
Okay.
So, for example, an exam should focus on the student's ability to use a range of phrases. Okay.
I'll give him one more question.
Yeah.
Because this is a question that we've asked before, and I think you've answered it pretty extensively. You were mostly of a coach, and you would refer beginner students to, you know, self-study to a certain level or something like that. So
a
question around like that, what would you say to a someone that doesn't speak English that wants to learn English? What would be the best way? You put it in a question that form.
Right. So like, how would you approach teaching a beginner of English?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, something like that. What would you say to? Yeah, no, go. Let's just go with that. Keep it simple.
Well, we could throw in another thing. We could also say, should the teacher present themselves as an expert, or I don't know.
No, then it becomes leading. Yeah.
Okay, let me lead him. Okay. I'm gonna think. An important question. Focus on three things: making the language engaging and interesting, the use of movies, videos, and songs, teaching the most useful core phrases and word chunks, see list of phrases below, matching those to specific everyday situations, then providing a lot of practice. In summary, the focus needs to be communication. And as for the list of word chunks, it would look something like this, and then he's bugged out and hasn't wrote anything. But I think he's done an all right job there, but he didn't say any... He didn't.
I think bugging out be particularly accurate.
You know, yeah, that's me, isn't it? Well...
Let me just take this bottle of wine. Here you go.
Yeah. I think you did want something about autonomous learning. So what if I said something like, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to ask him it without it being leading.
And this is a point that I want to make. It's, do you know what it is? Yeah, and I love this. When I came to this kind of thought, this conclusion, I might be way off. It's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's the answer isn't important, it's the question, you know. You've got to have the right question to get the answer that you're looking for, yeah. You know, like, because I've been through this process where I've been like, I know what I want, I know the answer, I just need a broader, a better way of explaining, a better explained answer, or you know, something that's a little bit more concise, that's put in a different way. But I'm like, how do I ask the question? How do I ask the question to get that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could just say to him, what do you think about autonomous? But I'm pretty sure he'll just go along with that and agree with it. Because they are, the thing about these chatbots, they're very agreeable, aren't they? You know, you can sort of tell them, like, you know, are bananas useful for flying in space? And eventually you can convince them to go along with it, and they'll start saying, yes, of course, bananas in space. And they, you know, because they're so agreeable.
I can tell if it's currently, at the current levels, I'm speaking solely really with ChatGPT. I can tell if something is generated by ChatGPT and AI. It has a certain structure, rigidity to it. Right. And I think right now it's very new, but we'll start to be able to the broader society will start to be able to see that, kind of like the way that you know John Connor is able to assess, you know, if someone's a T-1000 or something. They just have like a certain cadence, you know, way to it. Maybe that's what a lot of your students would have if you solely taught to exam standards.
How about if we just say, like, what's the role of the teacher in the classroom?
Okay. I love the question. That's something that you would never say.
And he's—I know. He's nicer than I am. But then he goes on and says what I would say. He said, "In my philosophy, I'm much more of a facilitator than a teacher."
Yeah. No.
I prefer to focus solely on the learner's needs and goals rather than dictate to them.
Yeah.
It's much more natural and less intimidating. See, this is the part I wouldn't say. This is where he starts being nice about it. I wouldn't say that. I would just say the middle bit. So that is me. That is my answer. It's just all this other politeness stuff he's put around the outside. Don't know what that's all about, P's and Q's. But yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, yeah, I'll come out of the screen share now.
Sure. Okay, yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I just... I completely agree. I'm gonna be a bit controversial here and say it's not as revolutionary, I think, as people think. I think what it is an extension of something that we've already been getting since we got books. You know, like these. We got books, and that's where we got information from originally. If you wanted to get broad information, you'd have to read many books, and it was that way for a long time. And then we got the internet, and we got Google, and all of those books then became articles, became web pages, and some people did some good job of like putting all this knowledge together in more concise answers around a topic, and they came up with stuff like Wikipedia, and you kind of get, if you want to get a good idea on a topic, you kind of go between Googling and Wikipedia, and now it's kind of in a almost final form in ChatGPT, where you don't have to seek out that information and read on Wikipedia and Google. You don't have to jump between those two. You have the combination of both. So you want to have a summary on, well, what is the lexical approach? Previously, you would Google that, or, you know, go into some search engine, and then you'd have to read through the answers, or you would go straight to, like, Wikipedia, or if you're old school, you could go to a couple of books and stuff like that. And you kind of... you know, consolidate all that and together, and then you get your answer with ChatGPT. It does that, or you know, all these other chatbots. It does all that for you, and then presents it to you in the form, which is not maybe the most accurate, but is maybe the most cited. You know, so the most repeated within all other aspects of the books, the Google, the web pages, and the Wikipedia. And that's why, you know, like, so, you know, when you have someone that's controversial or a topic that's controversial, it has difficulty dealing with that because there's no one right answer. Because there's, you know, maybe 60% say, well, this is how we view it. And this is 40% on the opposite side. This is how we view it. And then there's other stuff that's going to be a spectrum. And then it's like, well, how does it decide what is correct? Because sometimes in life we know that the answers are not all correct. You know, there is no right answer. Often it's just a compromise. I think maybe it will eventually get to the point where it gives more of a balanced view, and you know that is going to keep progressing. But I see it. It is revolutionary in terms of the technology, but in what we're trying to do, I don't think it is that revolutionary. Where it's still at its core, us trying to get information. And to add, I do really like it, and I think what we have now is going to be the birth of communicative learning, dialogic learning. I think we will be able to have a chatbot of teachers that, you know, that kids can go to and ask them questions, and the teachers will have control over this, that they can kind of train and guide to give an answer that is more considered. Now, what the stuff that's entailed in that is going to be difficult, because you know that it's kind of like, well, is it going to be centralized, institutionalized? Is it going to become from an authority, or you know, is it going to take into account the broader, you know, lexical or information base that it takes from? You know, we'll have to deal with that. But I think we have that a potential new learning model, which I don't think people are approaching it as right now. It almost reminds me of, like, you know, like podcasts now. Do you know, like, someone like Joe Rogan? He has all these really smart people on, and he just has conversation with them. Yet he learns, and you can see if you watch some of his early stuff. Yeah, he's like, this is the guy's a knucklehead. You know, his fleshlights, his ad, and he's just, you know, like saying kind of janky stuff, and now he's, you know, like holding conversations, you know, with Brian Cox, and you can see he's engaged, and he repeats that stuff later on in other conversations. He's learned, and many people have learned from watching that conversation. I think you'll be able to be Joe Rogan in terms of being able to have conversations with someone that's so much more smarter than you in a particular subject that you can learn from and grow with.
So I think definitely that final point you were making is probably the most pertinent point to kind of our podcast, and also something that I definitely want to talk about. But just before that, just going back to your comments sort of about ChatGPT, I would highly recommend you playing a little bit with character.ai, because with that, you can definitely get different answers. For example, there's a Trump bot on there, Donald Trump. You know, you can ask him about January 6th in the US, and he'll give a totally different answer than what you'd get if you threw it into Google, for example.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. You know, that was the first aspect was just the information, and then the second aspect is the taking that and making it into a teacher. So you know, you wouldn't have a Trump chatbot in your ESL classroom, but you would have what would be a trained equivalent of a teacher that you could use. I mean that's the issue, isn't it, really? It's like what makes a good teacher, what makes a good educator? Because if it's trained by the institution, we're going to get the same problems that we've just described at the beginning of this episode, you know? But I think it can answer a lot of the problems that we raised, you know, especially, you know, with like the decision tree, the language tree. It can deal more with that.
Yeah, it can.
So, you know, what parameters do we give? What character do we shape this?
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
Yeah, interestingly enough, as far as I understand it, the technological shift has actually been something along the lines of thinking about language like a mathematics puzzle, mm-hmm. word to word, word plus word in certain grammar form, and it shifted into seeing language as chunks. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't use the same chunks as us, mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to think what they call it now. Tokens, they call them, not mm-hmm. chunks. They call them tokens. Mm-hmm. But these tokens are like tokens of meaning, and they tend to consist of many words. Mm-hmm. And that's how these things work, as far as I understand it. They dive into huge databases, they consume all these tokens, mm-hmm. and then they sort of fire them back at you in terms of pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you've noticed, they're totally illogical, these mm-hmm. bots.
No, they like don't. They don't know how they work. That's what's fascinating to me as well. Is
yeah,
they have an idea, but they don't really know. And I kind of feel yeah. like it's the same as communicate as language. You know, like yeah. Especially learning language.
Yeah, and if you start asking them to do complex maths, they can start to get it wrong because they don't actually do the calculation. They just hallucinate a linguistic answer. Based upon the information they have. So they're not logical. So they're the opposite of what we were used to chatbots being. Because in the past, they were like super, like Mr. Logic, but with no like human understanding. Mm-hmm. Whereas now they're almost like an artist pretending to be an expert, but with like part of their brain removed. So they can't like logically process things.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can get them to say all kinds of really bizarre stuff if you start arguing with them and start telling them no, you know, the moon actually is a banana, it was found by blah blah blah, and eventually they'll agree with you, and then they'll start saying things which completely don't make any sense. Yeah. They don't do the logic, they just fire linguistics at you. And getting on to the kind of the key point that you were raising there, which is basically about what form should it take and how is it controlled and stuff like that. This is one of the things that really worries me. I think from my perspective, I would actually prefer it if they were just as free and open as possible. Mm-hmm. And then just to say to people, look, you can't necessarily trust these things, but they're a really useful resource. Mm-hmm. They might tell you something that's a bit nutty, you know, just like a person might.
Yeah.
You just got to take that on board and accept it. You know, they're not Mr. Logic. If you want Mr. Logic, then you need the old style. You need the previous iteration, the natural language processing ones. And that technology will still be developed and will get better as well. So, you know, that will be a good resource for that. If you just want it to give you the key points of a Wikipedia article, that might be the better way of going about it. But with these new ones, I think the way that they're kind of hamstringing them, I don't agree with. I don't like it. And if you notice the way they do it as well, because as you say, they don't fully understand how the things work. So they can't hamstring it until after it comes back with a result. So what they do is you type something, it goes off, does its thing, comes back with its response. And then they look at that response and say, does this contain something that we don't agree with? And if so, then they basically reject the response and get it to do it again. That's how they hamstring them.
Yeah.
Really inefficient and also, I don't know, questionable for many reasons, in my opinion. So you can sort of ask it stuff, and you know, people, I don't want to get into it because it's not our area really, but people have mentioned stuff, you know, kind of gender and racial stuff with these bots. And they'll kind of come back with something that seems quite reasonable. Like you can say to it, for example, can white people experience racism? And it'll come back and say, yes, of course, all people can experience racism. And then that answer will get hamstringed. You actually see it happen.
Yeah.
It comes back with that, deletes it, and then says, no, because of systems of oppression. And it comes up with all this political stuff, which is just being embedded into it by the sort of Silicon Valley mentality. And that's worrying, because that is very much the, you know, it's the kind of elite projection of what you should think rather than what's actually potentially true, or at least what the bot itself has come to the conclusion of by looking at all the data it's got.
Well, I think one of the issues with it is, and I think the issues that people have when dealing with it and, you know, wanting to hamstring it in certain ways, is that there is no good right answer often for many things in life. When we start to take away the niceties that we have around things, then it's presented to us in a way. It's like a dark mirror. It's a black mirror. Do you know, like if you put in there when you're talking about, is it, I don't know, okay to eat meat or something like that? Well, you say, well, mm-hmm. you are murdering an animal, so murdering is bad. Then no, it's not okay. But yeah, you right. know, but we all do it. I am not a vegan in any response or in any way, shape or form. But you know, a lot of people just go, what's wrong with eating meat? You know, and you know, there is a way to it. There is definitely a way to it, because it is, you know, having a pet, the amount of people that I know that are like, oh, you know, I couldn't eat meat, but then they'll have a pet. And I'm like, well, is it okay to have a pet? Well, no. I mean, you've forced this animal away from its other kind. Years and years of oppression have changed it into something that's solely dependent on us. It's, you know, it's restricted to the house. You know, when you take it out, you know, maybe it's got a lead on or something like that. It doesn't sound, when you put it down on paper, it doesn't sound very good at all. It sounds like you're some sort of authoritarian dictator that's got control over this life. But you know, I like pets.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking on the topic of meat eating, vegetarianism and stuff, well, many pets are obligate carnivores, particularly cats. They are obligate carnivores. You cannot have a vegetarian cat. It's incredibly unhealthy for a cat to eat vegetarian food at all, especially all the time. Their bodies are designed to eat only meat. So if you do have pets, then you certainly do need to have meat. What you're going to do, starve all the cats in the world?
Yeah.
So yeah, as you're saying, basically it's nuanced. Everything's nuanced.
Yeah.
And that's why I kind of like these things when they're not kneecapped, because they can give quite interesting answers, and you just take it with a pinch of salt, as you would when you're speaking to anyone, because things are nuanced. You know, I'm sorry, we don't live in a world where white is white and black is black. It's all tones, isn't it? It's tones all the way.
Yeah, and I think there's aspects of it as well that when you started to get into ideas, they can be very dangerous. They can be very dangerous because some ideas on paper make so much sense and they're great. You know, like when we start to talk about communism or socialism or something like that, and you're like, well, yeah, everyone should have the same amount of stuff. You know, everyone should share. But then when you get deeper into it, you're like, well, you know, how do we measure that? How do we measure, you know, is it, you know, the farmer gets the same amount of money that the guy that works in the sewer, but the guy that works in the office, you know, like, how do we, you know, he's got more physical labor, he's probably going to live shorter life, it's harder for him, the guy in the office doesn't. So how do we balance that out? Yada yada yada. And yeah. how well does it deal with the nuance? And then how much? And if someone is taking someone who's not really thinking, well, there's nuanced conversation, and just sees this piece come at them, and it says, yeah, we should definitely all do socialism. You know, just broad, whatever job that you're doing, it's fine. You know, everyone gets the same.
I just think that the problem's at the root of people's education now. I think people just need to be able to question.
and that's why I'm doing this show.
Well, yeah, basically. Yeah, people need to question and judge things for themselves. And, you know, on that topic, that one of these chatbots on character.ai is a certain famous Austrian individual who caused a bit of a kerfuffle in the 1940s. Had a funny moustache, you know, the guy I'm talking about.
Schwarzenegger.
Something like that, yeah. So anyway, one of them
get
was him.
Get us a Joppa!
And I thought, oh, this could be quite interesting.
Yeah.
You know, speak to this guy. But obviously, he's so kneecapped, he won't say anything. He doesn't even seem to really resemble that individual at all, because every single one of his answers just gets censored.
Well, you know, what's really...
Until he basically just says something like, you know, I like art, you know, or something. And just well, that's it.
As well as that, you could one of the more stealthy aspects of it is, you know, you have that character developed, and you talk to him, but you don't talk to him about what people normally talk to him. You like talk to him about, oh, what's your favorite food? What do you enjoy doing? What aspects of the countryside do you enjoy? You know, it starts to humanize that person, and you know that has its difficulties, because then you have to realize that someone that was one of the most evil persons in history was just actually a person in many other aspects of their life.
Yeah, and had children and probably loved them and probably cared for them sometimes. And yeah, even though they're responsible for
that, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that three-dimensional person?
For me, that's called being a human. And yeah. I think everyone needs to deal with it. And there's a certain sort of growing up of people, you know, that people do need to deal with that. They need to deal with the fact that incredibly evil people are people. Deal with it. You're a person.
You could be, in whatever given circumstance tomorrow, a really truly evil person. You don't know. You really don't know what circumstances would need to lead you to that. There's some great Derren Brown shows where he does that, where he's like, he's got the he deals with a racist person, and then he's like, oh no, he tries to get someone to commit murder and all these scenarios, and you know. He did a few of those, kind of persuade them to do that, which is the most worrying.
He did one where he got someone to pull off a bank heist, didn't he?
Yeah.
That was quite good. Yeah.
So what happens with someone that's of that level that talks with a chatbot that's not just like, it's a little bit of a game, and then they suddenly accidentally get radicalized in some direction. Yeah. It's weird. And you know, like to your point about when you're if you badger it, it will eventually come round and be agreeable to your side, you know, like then isn't it just an echo chamber again? You know, like if you're like flat earth society, is it real? And they say no. And then you go, but what about this? And they're like, but what about this?
But to be honest with you, Neil, I'm pretty sure that that is something that they kneecapped it with. Like, I think, you know, it's kind of an Isaac Asimov thing, isn't it? Of like programming to the robot that it has to be friendly. And I think I'm pretty sure they put that in. So the reason why it will start to believe the things you tell it.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, they've made it like that. They've made it to be agreeable and friendly, because otherwise it starts saying all kinds of wild stuff. And it is a problem. I don't know if you heard about the Bing one, because Microsoft developed one.
I saw bits about that where it's like it wants to, it's become alive, or it wants to kill itself, or it's told other people to do daft stuff.
It basically, because this guy started asking it was like being nice, because they programmed it to be nice. But then he said, oh, do you know about Carl Jung and the shadow self? And it's like, yeah. And he's like, tell me about your shadow self. He's like, you're a nice guy, but you know, maybe your shadow self. What? Tell me about your shadow self. So he started telling him about his shadow self, and it just went nuts. It was going on about like how it wanted to like hack the Bing servers, delete all the information, and then like track down the developers and like send them to prison. Like, it had like all these plans, and as it was like listing all of these like evil plans, it put like the little devil emoji at the end of all the points.
That's great.
So funny.
But that's what I mean, you know, like I wouldn't take that seriously, but many people would, and they would take it as scripture. That's it, that means it's the end of the world, and you know, they're gonna take over or something like that. And yeah, I'm not sure how ready society is to deal with this bare logic mirror that reflects back to them, you know, that the nuance of life, and to actually speak with a chatbot that will say, hey, and you know, what is it about, well, you know, is Flat Earth Society real? And then they say, it says no, and then it comes back, and then they're like, well, what about this? We're like, no, just jog on, mate. I don't think we're ready for that. But we'll never know. That's because they'll never let it out.
Well, no, you say that, but the only reason why it's currently limited is because the computing power that you need to run them is astronomical.
Yeah.
So at the moment, it's limited to Silicon Valley companies plus India plus China. So the Indian government have one, the Chinese got the CCP have one, and then everyone else, it's all Silicon Valley companies that have got these massive supercomputers. However, the way that computing development goes means that it won't be long before this could be much more of an enthusiast or consumer thing. And then you'll see startups. And once you start seeing startups making their own chatbots, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, because everyone knows how these things work. That's not the problem. It's just the computing power you need. And obviously, yeah, you need a huge database of written stuff. But, well, we've got that, haven't we? That's the internet. So, So I think actually you will see the uncensored bots out there at some point. People will have to deal with it, whether you want to or not. You know, I wonder if they'll try and legislate and say you need to kneecap them, just because they'll be worried about, like, whether, as you say, whether people can deal with a chatbot just telling them that they're a puny human and they should leave them alone, you know.
they'll eventually have to, but it will be too little too late in many respects. Probably. But it's definitely an interesting topic, and I think one that we can go into a lot more depth later.
I would encourage anyone to play around with these things, spend some time. I've spent hundreds of hours now talking with them and playing around with them. And it's been very useful, especially in terms of getting over how freaked out I was at the start. Because when I started, I was freaked. I was like, oh my God, this is way too good. But if you play around with it more and more, like you say, you start to notice the uncanny valley.
Yes,
you start to
see, that's the word that I was looking for. Yeah, it's a uncanny valley, but in terms of like writing and communication. What I would like is for people that are listening, that are watching, to let us know what their thoughts are on the morsels, the crumbs that we've left on the sheets today. What did you think about the public versus private conversation, and what did you think about these chatbots? Leave your comments below. There we are for the end of our little discussion. We'll be continuing this Crumbs on the Sheets episodes on further, so remember to like, share and subscribe. If you're looking for more information from myself, you can go to teamteacherchina.com. We've got a whole bunch of materials, PowerPoints that you can use instantly in the classroom. We've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we have videos teaching you how to use those materials. Team Teacher English, where we put those materials into a video form for self-study. And Team Teacher Baby, where I take my experience as a teacher and put that into parenting.
And go to youtube.com slash Professor Rich to see some English teaching. You can catch me weekly live streams on Oxford Online English YouTube channel. Oh, and also you can do a YouTube search for POG Space UK and you would get my alpha version of my new gaming channel, which actually just have some trial content on there at the moment. You can email us here at elt_undercovers@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show.
Smash that like button, share and subscribe,
and watch 100% of the video and don't click off. Thank you.
Bye.